The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. During World War II, news from the front was broadcast on radio. Television, famously, and maybe decisively, brought the havoc of the Vietnam conflict home to Americans on the evening news. Scenes of destruction and carnage in serious civil war are uploaded every day on YouTube. This one is from late February, showing what appears to be a direct hit on a Russian tank by a rebel group that claimed credit for posting the video. Thousands of similar videos reveal assaults, bombings, skirmishes, and their blood-soaked aftermaths in the multi-sided battle now playing out on several Syrian fronts. The Carter Center's Syria Mapping Project has been connecting these disparate dots of video to better understand the complicated and brutal conflict. Chris McNabow is manager of the project for the Carter Center, and we reached him via Skype. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, good to be here.
So the Carter Center started using YouTube videos to analyze the conflicts in Syria and Libya 4 years ago now. How much is being uploaded?
My estimations, it appears that there are more minutes of video than of real time coming out of Syria.
So what kinds of things are you looking for when you're analyzing this data, and how are you tagging it and cataloging it so other people can understand it?
Well, because of the difficulty of there being so much information, we started out focusing on the smallest yet most impactful pieces that we could handle. In the beginning, in 2012, for us, that was just following defections, trying to understand the rate of defections from the military, answering bigger questions like, is the military going to collapse in any fundamental way? And what's the opposition starting to look like? In the end of 2012, we partnered with a team of researchers who had been documenting a lot of the armed group formation videos. We brought them on board and we expanded yet again. From there, we've started looking at sightings of sophisticated weaponry or weapons that might have been foreign supplied and taking a look at how they flow through opposition networks. And more recently, with the advent of new tools, we've been able to track broader swaths of data and look at demonstrations and ongoing narratives, more conflict and videos of violence in general, and branch away from just those little bits that we were able to comprehensively handle in the beginning.
So you're able to identify things like, you know, you can see the uniform someone is wearing or the flag that they're flying under. How about weapons? Where are they coming from? These kind of supplies, food, that kind of thing. Can you tell what's happening from videos?
The formation videos that we've been tracking, we've been documenting up to 70 different attributes for each video, including, you know, the style of uniform, where it was shot, how many people, types of weapons seen. And when you start getting enough of that information, so for example, you mentioned weapons, that's where more traditional journalism comes in. You start researching who has supplies of these weapons in the region, where they're appearing in the country first, you know, if it's right next to the Iraqi border or the Turkish border or the Jordanian border, and trying to trace them back to a point of origin. Sometimes if you get a serial number from a weapon, it makes it very easy for you. But oftentimes it's putting together a whole bunch of different puzzle pieces to try and get a fuzzy picture.
Well, traditional journalism, of course, is the challenge here because there are very few people covering things in Syria. We know from the capture and then execution of James Foley from right here in New Hampshire, you know, that getting somebody to actually be able to report is really challenging. So does this become, in a way, journalism?
Yeah, and I think a lot of the people on the ground would say that they're journalists as well. It's not just Western journalists that go and put themselves at risk in Syria. If you look at a lot of these videos, you'll find people pointing the cameras down the barrel of a tank. You know, it's like Tiananmen Square, but from a whole different perspective. People are are uploading this, sometimes for political reasons, sometimes it's their the soapbox of an armed group or another, but oftentimes because they want the world to know what's going on.
Well, let's just hear an example here. Here's a video. This was marked as being uploaded in an area that was covered by the ceasefire that began in early February. This one dated March 3rd, so during the period of officially negotiated ceasefire. That's just an example of video from the Syrian conflict uploaded by citizens or rebels or soldiers or militants. By our guest Chris McNabo's estimation, there are more minutes of video of the Syrian conflict than there actually have been real-time moments of the conflict. So what do you do with all that? Well, Chris is manager of the Carter Center's Syria Mapping Project. They're using digital tools to catalog those videos and chart and report on the multi-sided conflict. Well, I have to admit, you know, looking through several videos from this conflict, a lot of things struck me. First, there just is this maze of content. I have no way of verifying who's uploading it. I don't read Arabic. So how do you source and make sure of the veracity of the videos that are being uploaded?
Well, our main focus is not to try and verify everything that's coming out. There's just too much content. We don't currently have the capacity to verify absolutely everything. But what we can do is we can use that as one of many sources and focus instead of on verification, on corroboration of information. And when we get videos of conflict happening in a place, oftentimes we can find it with satellite imagery. We can confirm that, yes, this is where a video was shot. If we also get reports of the conflict coming through activist networks or reporting networks, if we get reports of civilians being displaced from the same area, then we have a lot more confidence in what's actually happening. But it is an imperfect science, and the reflection that we see on social media is an imperfect reflection. So it's an ongoing challenge for us to sort through all of those uncertainties and difficulties in verifying what we see.
In other words, this kind of information might be helpful in, say, delivering humanitarian aid, for example, or knowing where the front was, but not something that the Department of Defense or CIA or a news organization might use for intelligence.
Well, certainly this information is useful for humanitarian distribution, understanding where the conflict is going and using that to try and respond to it and address it. But we have seen these videos used for military purposes. There's certainly that intent. For example, in the beginning of the conflict, there were some people who put live webcams on the rooftops so that they could show incoming artillery or planes or whatever was happening at the time. It didn't take long before people found those live streams and started targeting mortars towards them. The content being uploaded is uploaded for a wide variety of reasons, but it can also be used for just as wide a variety of reasons. Another example, in eastern Damascus, in the beginning of the conflict, we saw people uploading videos of what looked like man pads, these man portable air defense systems, which if it were true, it would have been a game changer in the beginning of the conflict. But it turns out that the air raids didn't stop on that area. The models of man pads that these opposition groups were holding up appeared to be fake or training models. So there's a lot of misinformation that goes out, and there's an intent behind it as well to not just pursue a political agenda, but oftentimes a military one as well.
This is one of the things that really struck me, that these videos are being uploaded. Of course, people want, as you said, the citizen journalist, the bystander, often want people to know what's going on in Syria. And I remember these messages a couple of years ago saying, you know, help, we need your help. But now I wonder, I mean, we know that ISIS is using videos from the conflict as propaganda and recruiting tools. Do you have any sense that the rebel groups are also catching on to that, sort of curating videos for foreign observers? I saw, you know, montages of the greatest explosions in the Syrian conflict and began to think, wow, this is taking on completely a life of its own.
I think everyone who's uploading videos is doing so with an agenda. That might not have been the case very early in the conflict, but people have understood or have come to understand the power of information. And this conflict is really taking place as much in the digital sphere as it is in the physical, on the ground, everyday lives of Syrians. There will be inaccuracies in videos that are uploaded. There will be an intent behind it or a political agenda in what it is that's being uploaded. But the amount of content, the sheer amount of content, means that you can begin to triangulate some sort of a truth between these different videos. You can start sorting through them and pulling out sometimes maybe not the whole message, but basic facts of where conflict is happening, where videos are being shot. It's hard to fake a large group of armed men storming a city. It's hard to fake tanks shooting at a city or airplanes above it. There are still useful bits of information that we can find in this mess of data.
So this montage tool that you're using, you're asking for some help from the public. This is a Google tool, have I got that right, or something that a Google tech incubator developed?
This was originally developed by Google Ideas following a conference that they held in 2013 called Conflict in a Connected World. The tool has gone through a couple different iterations. We've been testing it out for quite a while, but now it's been made public. As I was saying, the amount of information that's out there really requires a concerted effort from a large number of people. And if Syrians are really uploading this information, these videos, because they want the world to know what's going on, then we can help get that message out. We can help curate what would be an insurmountable amount of information and distill the story.
Well, we know the Carter Center has done a lot of work in humanitarian causes, in conflict resolution. How do you see this project working into your larger mission?
Well, this project was a bit of a departure from the norm for us. We really don't do too much think tank type work. We're really on the ground. But in the case of Syria, it's very difficult to be on the ground. And we started noticing a gap in people's analysis of the conflict. People weren't taking advantage of a lot of the new information that was coming out. And so we really tried to lean into that space and see if it could supplement our own work on the political side of conflict resolution in Syria. But also could contribute to broader humanitarian efforts. And it's certainly something that we're looking at applying to areas elsewhere. The conflict in Syria may be the first conflict to exist in such a connected environment, but it certainly won't be the last.
Chris McNabo, manager of the Carter Center's Syria Mapping Project, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
There's more on the project, including maps and timelines and a series of reports from the Syria Mapping Project so far. All that information is at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the early days of audio recording, there was little thought or understanding of how wax cylinders or vinyl records would stand the test of time. The ravages of fluctuating temperatures and oxidation have destroyed countless recordings and left others too fragile to replay, lest they be destroyed, then permanently lost. Producer Kurt Nickisch brings us the story of a new technology that allows archivists to preserve and play old audio files without touching them.
In the warmly lit Woodbury Poetry Room at Harvard University, researcher Mary Walker Graham is unwrapping a sealed wooden box like a gift. Inside is a sort of gift to the English language, a black record, a disc, the only one of its kind in the world.
It says in wax crayon in the center, it's written directly on the disc, Canto 56, Part 2.
It's a master recording of Ezra Pound in 1939, reading part of his epic poem, The Cantos. But the disc is falling apart.
You can see that the lacquer is beginning to come completely separated from the metal base. Once it gets to this phase, obviously it can't get anywhere near a needle. This is completely unplayable.
It's just one of thousands of archived recordings here of some of the most important poets of the recording age, T.S. Eliot, Sylvia Plath, Robert Frost. But they've been too damaged to play until today. Mary Walker Graham has always wanted to listen to a fragile T.S. Eliot recording never heard before with a written note saying, extra word at end.
Where instead of in the end of his famous poem, The Hollow Men, which everyone knows the line, the world ends not with a bang but a whimper, I had a dream that it was not with a bang but a chicken cluck. Just last night. So we'll see.
Mary Walker Graham will now be able to hear that last word thanks to a new service from the nonprofit Northeast Document Conservation Center, NEDCC, in nearby Andover, Massachusetts. The center is now offering a preservation technology called Irene to museums, archives, and private collectors.
Irene can do something that no other technology can do, which is put Humpty Dumpty back together again.
NEDCC director Bill Viette says his laboratory traditionally preserves paper documents, books, maps, photographs, often by taking high-resolution images for posterity. Now, the center has begun taking pictures of voices.
This part's easy.
Audio technician Mason Vanderloot is operating the Irene machine. It's a high-tech turntable that looks more like an industrial workbench. As the fragile record slowly spins, a 3D camera takes high-resolution pictures of the microscopic scratches etched into its grooves. Then, Vanderloot uses computer software to convert the images of the microscopic squiggles to sound. Sound that had been lost to the ages, like the one gouged side of a Robert Frost recording from around 1940.
That's the second side of this recording where the engineer scraped out the recording so nobody would play it. And we get to go against his wishes and find out what's on it anyways.
On the gouged side of the disc is this poem.
The road not taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one.
Each time the software comes across the gouge that you can see in the image, there's a pop, but that's an accurate representation of the disc that we have.
This invention, named Irene, was inspired by a story on public radio.
And at that time, I was driving back and forth to Silicon Valley.
Carl Haber was stuck in a traffic jam, listening to his local public radio station, KQED, when a story came on about the state of endangered archived sound recordings. Haber is a physicist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He was studying the surface of silicon, trying to understand its shape and how particles reacted on it.
And then I heard the thing about the sound recordings, and that idea about looking at images of particles turned into looking at images of sound. It's just one of those accidental things.
Woo! Oh, I need to speed up a little.
Now Haber's accidental eureka is creating sonic euphoria at Harvard's Woodbury Poetry Room. Researchers Christina Davis and Mary Walker Graham have been devouring all the sound from decrepit records that Irene has saved. They were delighted with poet Marianne Moore's normal speaking voice, something you never hear in commercial recordings. They recovered the only Wallace Stevens reading of It Must Change from 1954, part of his poem, Notes Toward a Supreme Fiction.
A single text, granite monotony. One soul face, like a photograph of fate.
Stevens scholar and literary critic Helen Vendler says this newly recovered recording added to her understanding of him.
It's important to hear the way he hears his own lines, because that isn't always conveyed on the page.
Among the sound recordings that have been saved is that T.S. Eliot record from 1947 with the mysterious note about the extra word at the end, the one Mary Walker Graham had been dreaming about. Here's what that extra word is.
What shall I cry? We demand a committee, a representative committee, a committee of investigation. Resign, resign, resign.
That's it. just an accidental cut-off word at the end of the recording. It wasn't a chicken cluck, but it was close. Mundane or poetic. That's the power of this technology, unbreaking broken records, so that the fading voices of the 20th century don't go out with a whimper, but come back with a bang. I'm Kurt Nikisch.
And after the break, our present-day investigations of the past continue. We're going to talk with a man who reproduced a covered wagon to follow what remains of the Oregon Trail. Westward Ho, when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When America was young, the West was a wild frontier full of bounty and promise, but without a path to get there. It was fur trappers and traders who laid the groundwork for what became the Oregon Trail. A 2,200-mile route, beginning in Missouri, that snaked its way through the prairies and mountains to the valleys of Oregon. The trail united the coasts and doubled the size of the country. In the 15 years leading up to the Civil War, nearly 500,000 people packed up their covered wagons to follow that trail in what scholars refer to as the largest land migration in history. These days, the Oregon Trail is splintered, with many parts overgrown, paved over, or all but forgotten. Author and journalist Rinker Buck decided to do what no one has done in more than a century, cross the Oregon Trail in a covered wagon. We spoke to him when his book chronicling the event, The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey, was first published. It's now out in paperback. When we spoke, I asked Rinker Buck why he embarked on such a slow and potentially perilous journey.
Well, it's kind of a case, I think, of what makes you think I'm crazy makes me feel comfortable, you know. But what happened was I became fascinated with the Oregon Trail about 6 or 7 years ago, and I started reading up on it. And what moved me so much was how much the trail experience reminded us of the country we have today, and that the history that was important was not the history that had been taught to us in schools. So women played a very important role in the trail. Religious schisms and all kinds of... America was a very, very divided and contentious religious place in the 19th century. Religion played a very big role. It wasn't one trail. It was really a collection of trails. So all of these things were fascinating to me. And then as I'm studying the trail, I come across this sentence: the last documented crossing of the Oregon Trail was in 1909. And I go, yeah, but I mean, I'm a horse guy. That's the book. That's what I'll do. And it becomes a question of whatever is eccentric or whatever is different about your childhood or your past. It empowers you. It enables you to go out and do something that other people wouldn't think to do. I had the self-confidence to know that I could get there. Then I got out on the trail and it was a disaster, but, you know.
But that makes a great book, and it's also a little bit memoir. You are one of 11 children. You took one of your brothers with you on the trip, your youngest brother, Nick, who couldn't seem more opposite, which made you kind of an odd couple on the road.
I understand you come from a large family, too, so you know what I'm about to talk about. You know, it's like, you know, I love my brother, but, you know, he's sort of working class and blue collar. And
rather potty mouthed.
That's the polite way to say it. Potty mouthed. I have to start using that. And I'm, you know, I'm sort of the pretentious older brother, you know, who has a college education and likes antiques and fine wine, you know. And if we had a day when we had to fix the wagon, I would offer to help him fix the wagon, you know, because we broke our wheels a lot and things fell apart. And he'd go, I don't want your college educated butt anywhere near this wagon, you know. So it's also a story of brothers.
Well, you initially had planned on making the trip alone. Now, why didn't you?
I just thought I could do it alone. I didn't have anybody that I knew would come along. I figured I could do it myself. I had all kinds of imagination of myself riding a nice horse and leading the team of mules that pulled a wagon by a lead line and all this kind of thing. And immediately, instantly, within 2 hours of being on the trail, but especially at night when we had to make camp and take the harness off, bathe the mules, all that kind of stuff. It's Daniel Boorstin called, the historian Daniel Boorstin called the covered wagon plainly a community vehicle. It needed groups of people in order to work, and that's why they had the wagon trains. So very quickly into the trip, I realized how lucky I was that my brother was available to come on the trip, and he's a much better team driver and mechanic than I am.
Well, why not do it in a truck or an RV with a shower? I mean, were you trying to prove something here?
I wasn't trying to. The history drove it. But I also liked the sort of narrative cocoon that I created by riding by in a covered wagon 150 years after the pioneers went. You're still seeing the same things, and you're also seeing different things. And it was fascinating. I mean, one thing I discovered that's just fascinating is, so in eastern Kansas and Nebraska, which are relatively habited, we would come to places where children would run to the end of their driveway with apples and buckets of water for the mules. And we would stop the wagon. After a while, we kind of were dodging them, but because we wanted to make progress. But we would stop the wagon and talk to the kids and everything. And I started to notice that the parents were the wrong age. The parents were all very old. And so I finally asked one of the parents, and there's a whole generation of children out in the West, Midwest, being raised by their grandparents because their biological parents, the sons and daughters of the grandparents, have spun off on, they would say to me, it was the recession and meth, you know. And of course, methamphetamine is quite an epidemic out there.
Right, out in the West.
And then when I got back, I looked it up and there was this huge spike in demographics. It was one of three major changes in the demography of the country that the Census Bureau pointed out between 2000 and 2010 census. And I encountered it all across the West. There's I think it's something like 12 million children now being raised by their grandparents.
That's unbelievable.
Now, you asked me, why didn't I take a minivan? Okay.
Right.
Well, nobody's going to run out for apples for your minivan.
Right.
You know, it was so ironic. By plodding along with a team of mules and an authentic covered wagon at 4 miles an hour, I actually saw more of my country today. I was riding a sort of a social observation point than I would have if I drove, sped along the highway in a car.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Plus, the country's beautiful from a while.
Well, is it all still passable? I mean, is it all, there is, must be private property in a lot of parts of the Oregon Trail. Were you able to cross it all?
Yes, we crossed it all. The only few places, there were a few places in Idaho where they put in irrigation canals that really made it. If I had to do the trip over again, I would have carried a little portable bridge. But yes, about half of the trail is now paved over mainly into small blacktops, you know, something like Route 9 in New Hampshire, two-lane blacktops. And I didn't mind that at all because that's history. The road that the pioneers took turned out to be the best route somewhere. So about half of the 2,000-mile trip was on paved roads, and then another 1,000 miles was just beautiful old dirt roads right along the Platte River and in Wyoming, there's 350 miles, and we took every inch of it, of original ruts down through beautiful places. And it's also a portrait of the generosity of the country and how it is out West now. You know, we camped in rodeo corrals. We camped on ranches. We camped at a couple times we camped on golf courses and stuff like that. So the trail's all that's still there, and the spirit is still there.
How long did it take in the end for you and Nick?
It took 4 months. You're going from Missouri to Oregon through six big western states, and we made 79 camps. You know, we camped 79 times. So,
I'm speaking with a longtime journalist and author, Rinker Buck, about his new book, The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. It is part family memoir, and it's part travelogue, and it's part history, and part dispelling the myths of history, one being that it was dominated by men. But you, Rinker, discovered otherwise. Tell us about this woman, Narcissa Whitman.
So Narcissa Whitman was a classic product of early 19th century America, which was that she was, there was a great evangelization movement early in the century called the Second Great Awakening. And so she became converted, and on her conversion moment, you know, when she was born again, she had a vision that she had been placed on earth by God to evangelize the Indians out west. To make the story short, basically, she found another missionary who was dying to go out west. He had already traveled out west, Marcus Whitman. She married him on the spot, basically. They basically had an arranged marriage and then fell in love on the trail. They got married and they left the next day to make this very perilous journey in 1836 across what is now the Oregon Trail. And it was a very significant journey because the big cultural bias against a trail crossing at that time in America was that women and children would not be able to make it.
Mm-hmm.
There was fur trappers out there, and those guys were kind of strange, and they'd marry into the Indians and stuff. But a white woman and kids, and you needed your wife and your children if you were going to file a claim and get free land out there. So Narcissa Whitman took the trip in a covered wagon. She was the first white woman to cross the Rockies. But what made it significant was her letters home to her family were published. And she said things like, oh, if you could see me today crossing the river in a canoe filled with all our trunks, you know. And she reassured America the rivers were safe, which was a very difficult thing in America at that time, and that the Indians were friendly. And they were initially.
So the another cowboy myth dispelled. Oh,
the cowboys
were
and
friendly.
Indians, yeah. Tragically, later on, after she settled in Oregon and everything, actually Washington State, but she was massacred by the Indians because being a missionary at that point was difficult. I'm pretty sure that's why she was forgotten to history. You know, you don't bring up someone like that and keep... But she, it was her letters home and how literate and laughing and fun they were, and the fact that she's falling in love with her arranged marriage husband as they go west, you know, mesmerized America and convinced Americans we could go on the trail. And then Marcus Whitman came back east one year and in 1843 led what was called the Great Migration. And it was the first big wagon train of about 1,000 people.
Mm.
And she's totally forgotten today. She had an immense impact on American history. So yeah, I devoted a whole chapter to her in the book and I found her quite, she was my guardian angel on the trail.
Any other revelations for you about how this trail forged not just a path west, but a way of life in America?
Well, I think there were many other things, but we probably don't have time, but like the pioneers were terrible environmentalists and that kind of thing. You could literally, by the late 1840s, early 1850s, you could navigate all the way to Oregon just by the debris pile.
Oh.
It was America's sort of first...
First great dumping ground.
Yeah, first great dumping ground or a Superfund site. But all in all, it was a grand adventure. And one of the most fascinating things I read about in the book, I felt, was the cholera was very bad, of course, along the Platte River, and they didn't know how to cure cholera then. So you would sometimes pass 10, 15, 20 trail graves right beside the ruts. But what was amazing was, I quote like Polly Coon and Amelia Jane Scott, and they would see all these graves every day, and there was so much suffering. They'd come into the camps at night, and people would be dying. But the countryside was so beautiful. Their journal would be full of the beauty of the country or Chimney Rock. And so this was a thoroughly American trait, that there was a romance, there was a beauty, there was a something larger than itself drawing us across the plains to create a single continental mass. And we did that despite the horrible tragedy that they went through.
What do you think about having crossed the Oregon Trail and seen its significance in our country's history? Mm-hmm. Do you think there is, are you ready to lead a charge or call for renewed preservation of the trail?
Yes, and there's a significant efforts that way. But I have a sort of a mini essay within the book where I rage about the Tea Partyists and the people that, you know, everyone, oh, taxes are too high and government spends too much. When you ride the Oregon Trail in a covered wagon, you camp almost every night at old campgrounds that became then called camp towns because people needed a place to stay for a few weeks until their land claim was approved by the government. Then they became resting places and big barracks and camps, the same place for soldiers in World War I and World War II. They became shanty towns during the Depression and so forth. And I explain, I just give the chain of Providence what happened, but it was federal government spending that kept these places open. And then during the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's WPA and CCC workers turned these into nice places with bathrooms and showers and stuff. Well, we camped almost every night at what was originally a pioneer campground and is now a beautiful state park or something like that. So the preservation has already happened. So, I kind of make a passionate argument for preservation. And I explain a lot. There's some wonderful characters in the book who, you know, they have an old ranch and there's a Pony Express stable on the ranch. And the rancher's getting old. It's always been in his family. He's kept it up. And now he just surrounded it in an implement shed so it's permanently preserved. Things like that. It's very touching. You get a sense of the country as a generous, open place. It was a very lyrical journey.
I lived in a place called Ofuskee, and I had a little girl in a hollow tree. I said, little girl, it's plain to see, ain't nobody that can sing like me.
Rinkerbuck there, author of The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey, which is now out in paperback. You'll find a link to read more about the book and about his upcoming event at Writers at the Loft in Portsmouth on June 9th. That's all at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
There ain't nobody that can sing like me. We walk down by the Buckeye Creek to see the froggy, the goggle-eyed bee, to hear that west wind whistle to the east. There ain't nobody that can sing like me. Ain't nobody that can sing like me.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Ultra running was once an anomaly in the world of competitive running, attracting just a handful of crazy people. Ultra athletes who seemed addicted to the idea of pushing their bodies to the brink. These endurance athletes who run for distances of 100 miles and more are becoming more and more mainstream, garnering sponsorships from companies like the North Face, New Balance, and Patagonia. And as more and more athletes are racing at distances that would scare off most marathoners, a rare and debilitating condition is becoming all too common among them. Megan Brown is associate editor at Outside Magazine, where she wrote about overtraining syndrome. And Megan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Megan, what are the symptoms of overtraining syndrome?
Overtraining syndrome actually can mimic a host of other diseases. So it can look like leukemia. It can look like Addison's disease. A lot of what you're seeing is profound fatigue, strange muscle soreness, really strange blood counts, low testosterone, just a host of various things. Some athletes feel like they've had 6 cups of coffee and can barely sleep or have strange heart palpitations. So it really ranges.
Well, that sounds like it's something that could happen to someone who really overexerts themselves. So what's the difference between an elite runner, say, really pushing themselves in training and overtraining syndrome?
So overtraining syndrome is what happens when the body is pushed to its ultimate brink, and it really has to do with the central nervous system and how the central nervous system is able to respond. Overtraining syndrome is basically what happens when the body is in this sort of extremely stressed state for a really long time and can't pull itself back.
So there's no recovery.
Right. They're not recovering in the same way that they were previously. So the body just keeps pushing itself and pushing itself and pushing itself, and they're not getting the benefits of recovery. And so it just continues to get more and more stressed.
Is it just ultra runners who are experiencing this or other extreme sports?
There have been cases recorded in a lot of other extreme sports. It happens to mountaineers, and it happens to triathletes as well. It was called chronic fatigue syndrome in the 90s in the triathlon circuit. They weren't referring to it as overtraining syndrome, but it's essentially the same thing.
Why is it so difficult to diagnose OTS? And this is even among medical professionals who do work regularly with athletes.
So medical professionals are only starting to even know what to look for. And because it mimics so many other things, it's easier to rule out all other possibilities before you diagnose someone with overtraining syndrome. And you can't, in a controlled environment, study what's actually happening in the body, what's going on at a muscular level and a neurological level, because inducing overtraining syndrome in somebody who's healthy is unethical. Mm-hmm. And so they've really only been able to study overtraining syndrome on a case-by-case basis. And a lot of runners, they go long enough without having this diagnosed that there haven't been enough cases really studied.
I imagine that to summon the kind of endurance, there has to be not just a sort of body pushing, but also a mental pushing. Is there a sort of mental strain of endurance sports or overtraining component here?
Yeah, there's a huge mental component to all of this. They say that to run 100 miles, it's 75% mental, 25% physical. So you really have to be able to draw on the mind and body in order to accomplish these feats. And there's some thinking that that sort of mental exhaustion also contributes to physical exhaustion because it's all stress on the body, whether that's mental or physical stress. So those two things are basically feeding off of each other. And if you're stressed in your mind, it's harder to make your body less stressed. And if you're stressed in your body, it's harder to make your mind less stressed.
Well, I am not one of those people who's like deeply committed to digging further, harder in exercise. But I'm wondering about whether people are kind of addicted to exercise on some level. It must make it hard for them to quit, even when their body is pleading with them to stop, because that's what training is. You just keep going.
Certainly. And I think a lot of people, even people who aren't predisposed to getting overtraining syndrome, will say it's really easy to get addicted to running. I mean, you have these endorphins running through your body. It's something that you love. And for these elite runners, a lot of them, this is how they self-identify. I mean, this is their livelihood. This is how they make money, support their family, and it's the thing that they love the most.
So what is the prognosis for athletes with OTS? Any kind of options for treatment?
The only treatment, and every sports medicine doctor will tell you this, is rest. And they don't really know, because it hasn't been studied enough, whether 2 years of rest is going to cure somebody completely. There's some thinking that overtraining syndrome never really leaves your body. I mean, some people have gone so far as to say that it changes the DNA structure of your muscles.
Hmm.
I did speak with a couple of athletes for this story who said even after years of rest, if they go out for a long run or have a lot of life stress going on, the symptoms come back. Rest is really the only treatment.
So people have heart palpitations, various forms of anxiety, or they have trouble sleeping. How about, you know, just in their regular daily lives, can they still function?
Yeah, in their daily life, I mean, it's definitely there. You know, that profound exhaustion is going to play into all aspects of your life. And some people do have trouble concentrating and all these other things. A lot of these people are running professionally, and so they are able to sort of step away from running and really rest. But for people who have full-time jobs, on top of training like this, it can be a really, really difficult thing to deal with.
Megan Brown, Associate Editor at Outside Magazine. That's where we found her article, Running on Empty. You'll find a link to read more about overtraining syndrome, or OTS, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org, including your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like it, please write a review, please pass it along, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
We're just lovers, but I'll only